sports, and Don't Throw Stones, taken from the double CD entitled Songwriters Speak, Songs by Great Australian and New Zealand Songwriters. And it's kind of a companion to the book that Debbie Kruger has written entitled Songwriters Speak, Conversations About Creating Music. It's out through Limelight Press. And just some of the artists that she has interviewed in this book, and it's quite a comprehensive list of artists, going right back to early days in Australian music, right up to contemporary times. But just running down the list, people like Harry Vander and George Young, Jim Keys, Brian Cadd, Ross Wilson, Billy Thorpe, through to Garth Porter, Richard Clapton, Tim Finn, Ivor Davies, Nick Cave, Mark Seymour, Paul Kelly, Deborah Conway, Archie Roach, Daniel Johns, Casey Chambers, amongst many others. It's a very, very lengthy tome. You certainly wouldn't want to get hit around the head with the book. It's quite a sizable piece of work, but a very interesting read. And I actually started off asking Debbie what was the motivation behind, or the inspiration behind, writing the book.
I guess the main inspiration was a book that I'd read on American songwriters by a man named Paul Zoller called Songwriters on Songwriting, a very serious anthology of in-depth Q&A interviews on songwriters that really took me on a journey of the history of American songwriting. I'd been reading a lot of books on music. I'm a voracious reader of music books. And although we have had several good books written about the Australian music industry, nobody had tackled this subject. Nobody had spoken to the songwriters, who are the creative backbone of our music industry. I also, you know, came to the project with a lifelong obsession, passion for music, and a PR career in the music industry, including several years working for APRA, the Australasian Performing Rights Association, working with songwriters and composers, interviewing them for the Members Journal, and working on the APRA Music Awards. So I had a lot of things that brought me to the point where I thought, somebody needs to write this book, and I think it should be me. And the real trigger was Ted Mulry's death in 2001, because, you know, I'd had this idea swimming around, ooh, an Australian version of Songwriters on Songwriting. That would be good. And Ted would have been one of the people I would have wanted to speak to, and he died. And then I thought, oh, God, Peter Allen, gone. Mark Hunter and Paul Hewson, gone. Michael Hutchins, gone. Ted Mulry, gone. No more. Someone's got to do this. So I started.
And hence the book. In terms of the original concept to the book that we now see, how many years?
4.5 total, from start, first interview, the first idea that I could do this, to it coming out.
And no doubt many, many hours as well.
Oh, many hours, hundreds of hours of tape to be transcribed, many, many days, weeks, months of research and preparation. Every single interview was very thoroughly researched. And, you know, the most enjoyable part, of course, was just having the conversations and meeting with the songwriters. And I always enjoyed that. But all the beforehand stuff and all the after stuff was very laborious and very, you know, insular. That real writer in the garret syndrome. There's no one, you know, I didn't want to hand over my tapes for someone else to transcribe, because I knew when somebody had smiled as they made a comment, and I was the only one who could transcribe that particular expression. So I needed to do everything, and also I'm a bit of a control freak.
Musicians are generally known as a fairly sort of contrary bunch of people, especially the kind of songwriters, the creative kind of people. Who was the hardest person to sort of nail down to get to commit to the book?
Oh, okay. They were all quite willing participants. Don Walker asked a lot of questions about who else was going to be in the book, but once I told him I had Vander and Young and I had Richard Clapton lined up and named a few other names, he was fine. Nick Cave took a while to pin down, but it wasn't because Nick wasn't interested, because, in fact, when I got together with Nick, the first thing he said was, is this anything like that American book, you know, that call somebody Songwriters on Songwriting? And I went, hello, yes, this is exactly like that book. That's the template for this. He said, I thought so, and I wanted to do this interview from day one. His PA, his personal assistant, had been doing what she thinks she's paid to do, which is say no. And she said no relentlessly for a few months. Really nice girl. But, you know, an English Londoner who really doesn't have a clue about the Australian industry. And I kept saying to her in emails, do you understand, if I don't put Nick in this book, I will be lynched. There will be a lynch mob after me. You can't write a book, a serious book on Australian songwriters, and not have Nick Cave. He's that important. You have to do it. And I just wore her down. Mm. You know, she'd say something like, well, you know, even if I schedule in an interview and you come all the way over to England, he might cancel at the last minute. And I would respond, well, he might, but he might not. So let's schedule it in. Rolf Harris was also took a long time to pin down. But again, Rolf, I had actually approached Rolf direct first, and he said, yeah, love to have a chat. Here's my publicist's details. And then she took a long time to sort of lock it in. When I dealt direct with the songwriters, it generally was not a problem at all.
Mm.
And even some that I thought might be a bit difficult, like Daniel Johns, because he's just been so busy and you know, he'd just gotten married. His manager, John Watson, was fabulously cooperative because he understood the nature of the project, and it just happened.
Mm. There are so many people that you have interviewed in the book, and I don't want to dwell on who is not in the book, but there must have been a couple of people on your wish list in your mind that you were chasing that you weren't able to kind of get.
Yeah, yeah. Greg and Kanish didn't want to do it. He had his reasons. He wanted some sort of recompense for giving me his great words and thoughts. He thought he would be entitled to something, and I approached him very early on because I just thought he was... It was par for the course that I'd have to have Greg McCanish in this book. He's such an important link in our musical history. And this is the guy that coined phrases that are part of our vernacular now that weren't previously. Living in the 70s, would we have said that if he hadn't written the song? I don't know. All my friends are getting married. Ego is not a dirty word. I really wanted him in the book, and I approached him a few times, and he was constantly resistant, and I hope that he looks at the book now and is most regretful about that. I really tried to get Barry and Robin Gibb. I think it's arguable whether they are Australian songwriters, but in Australia we like to claim anyone who spent 5 minutes here as our own, and if you're given the opportunity to have an audience with Barry Gibb, you don't say no, and I would have been on the next flight to Miami because their songwriting has influenced not only me but so many of the songwriters I did interview. A lot of people look up to Barry Gibb, and there were a lot of his contemporaries in the book, going back to Johnny Young and Billy Thorpe and people like that. But you could write a book this size just on the Bee Gees songwriting. Unfortunately, I did get very close. I spoke to Barry's manager, and he was doing his best, but the thing is that after Morris died, Barry closed up. He just he didn't want to talk, and he still doesn't. So, unfortunately, that didn't happen. They were the main ones that disappointed me. There were a few others, but I have such a big list, and I really fought for the integrity of this project and wanted it to be long form, and I wanted the interviews to be long. So I had to draw the line somewhere anyway.
Paul Kelly and the great track To Her Door, taken from the CD Songwriters Speak, and we're in the middle of our interview with Debbie Kruger, who has written the book Songwriters Speak, Conversations About Creating Music. You're listening to Triple RFM. Let's rejoin the interview with Debbie Kruger, and we were talking about what makes a good song, and I said to her that we all have subjective opinions.
Yes, absolutely. There are some Australian songs that have been hailed as, you know, greatest Australian songs that I just don't hear it myself as something that's appealing to my ears. And there are songs that I absolutely treasure that some of my contemporaries don't feel anything for. But I think the whole point of songs and songwriting is that it is something quite enigmatic and magic and marvellous. And one thing that became very clear as I spoke to all these great songwriters, some of whom can speak about the creative process quite articulately and some of whom can't, is that nobody has been able to unlock the mystery of where songs really come from and where the muse resides. And I think most of the songwriters are quite content, and I certainly came out of this project content to not have solved that mystery, because it keeps the magic alive. Every time you hear a new song, it's like, wow, how did that happen? And as somebody who is not a songwriter or a musician or player of any kind, when I hear a song and it grabs my attention, I'm just so amazed and so in awe of that. It's a piece of magic. So to find that the songwriters really felt that way. I mean, Paul Kelly said that he can be quite astonished sometimes by the creation of a song. And Neil Finn said that he still has no idea where the source of that inspiration comes from, that it's still quite a mysterious thing. I think those sorts of quotes from the songwriters are much more interesting than, oh, well, I know where songs come from, and it's nothing special. I mean, who wants to hear that? There wouldn't have been a book in this if everyone had that answer.
Yes, yes. Are you someone who is captured by the lyrics or by the music first?
Funny enough, I think it's actually the music, because there are some songs that I really didn't hear the lyrics properly until much later in my life. But a good lyric, I mean, is invaluable, and there are songs that I might have heard when I was a very young kid that I don't hear for 30 years, and I can still sing the lyrics the next time I hear it, because you're growing up, you're listening to commercial radio in the 70s as I was, and these songs are just played on high rotation and you hear them all the time, and they just totally permeate your consciousness, or your subconsciousness as it may be. So they come back and 30 years later and bite you on the bum almost, and you go, oh, yeah, I remember that. That's so cool. So lyrics, are very important, but you don't necessarily know you don't really necessarily hear those lyrics. You remember them. Mm-hmm. You can sing them off by heart, but you don't necessarily have absorbed them. Whereas the music, a catchy melody, is probably what grabs me first. But it's like I ask songwriters what comes first, the lyrics or the melody, and for many of them, they come together. And I suppose that's how a really good song leaves an instant impression, that every part of it just hits you in the face and you think, wow.
20 minutes to 10 o'clock, and indeed it is Triple RFM and it is the Australian Mood, and, when things don't quite work out the way you'd planned, there's kind of two alternatives, really. You can throw a wobbly or you can sit here and laugh. And I must admit, the track that I wanted to play you there was Nick Cave and the Bad Season, a track entitled Nobody's Baby Now. But for some particular reason, the CD player here at Triple R decided that it wanted to hear a bit of In Excess. But there we go, another track from Songwriters Speak. Maybe we'll play some Nick Cave next week. Let's rejoin the interview with Debbie Kruger, talking about the book Songwriters Speak, Conversations About Creating Music. And we pick up the interview. I said to her, who were some of the favourite interviews in the book?
Well, one that I really enjoyed and one who really moved me was John Farah. A lot of people don't even know who John Farah is. He's a Melbourne guy. He grew up in Moonee Ponds. He was in The Strangers, a Melbourne band in the 60s who were renowned for their high harmony singing, very influenced by the Beach Boys, and then became a supreme guitarist and arranger and played on a lot of classic Melbourne songs like The Real Thing and Smiley and tons of songs that were recorded around what was the studio that was really big in Melbourne back in the 60s and 70s?
TCS, Armstrong's.
Armstrong's, yeah. Yep. He was like house guitarist and arranger at Armstrong's. John Farah went over to England, hooked up with Olivia Newton-John and started producing her early songs. So he was the producer on I Honestly Love You. But then he moved over to America with her and he wrote everything from Have You Never Been Mellow and Sam to those great songs from Greece, You're the One That I Want, Hopelessly Devoted to You. I mean, you could retire on You're the One That I Want Alone. Magic, which I think is the only brilliant song from the Xanadu soundtrack, and has gone on to do, very unusual projects like Heathcliff for Cliff Richard. But John is a very painfully shy man, something of a musical genius and a bit of a tortured genius, has such high standards for himself. And just the way he spoke so hesitantly about his creative process because he doesn't do interviews. He's very much a behind-the-scenes man. I was just terribly moved by him. I found, you know, he's married to Pat Carroll, who started out singing with Olivia Newton-John. He's, you know, they've been married 35 years. He's been in the industry for 40 years. But he just isn't comfortable talking about himself. But he did so graciously. I found him moving. Tim Finn was such a joy. He's got such a beautiful mind, and he shared that with me so generously, and he spoke eloquently and elegantly, and it's almost like he talks in a stream of consciousness style, but everything just fits beautifully and leads from one thing to the next. And he talked very candidly about his songs and about his relationships in Split Enz and his devastation about when Phil Judd left Split Enz, and I Hope I Never was written about that. Both he and Neil spoke very openly about their relationship with each other personally and songwriting-wise. They talked with such fondness about New Zealand and the sense of place that's so evident in their work. And I did find him one of my favourites. And my experience of Nick Cave turned out to be one of my favourites, and I was very open with Nick. I told him that I hadn't been a fan of his work, that I had studied him specifically for the purpose of the interview and the book, but I'd studied him quite in a detailed way, and I'd listened to everything he'd recorded, and I'd read his biography, and I'd read interviews he'd done, and I came with a lot of questions, and that personal assistant who had tried her best to rebuff me had told me I could have 1 hour, and Nick gave me 3 hours, and we got through the questions. And when I listened back on the interview to transcribe it, I realized how funny he was, how much we laughed together, and how we really clicked, because he really appreciated the approach I made and the seriousness and the respect that I had for his work in my questioning. I wasn't interested particularly in his heroin addiction. It's kind of, we all know that story. So let's talk about God and love and family and how these things are evident in his work and specific songs that I wanted to hear the stories behind. So I had a great time with Nick.
And have you become a fan of his music?
Absolutely. I went to my first Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds concert. You know, I was a Sherbet fan, and I'm not ashamed to say it. I grew up in the 70s listening to 2SM in Sydney. I listened to Sherbet, Little River Band, Dragon. Pop music, Countdown, you know, Peter Wilmot's group, Glad All Over the Countdown Years, is like a love letter to me, you know. I love that stuff. So moving into the 80s, I wasn't the kind of candidate for, you know, to be a Nick Cave fan. But I am a fan now because mainly from Tender Prey on, I don't think that his earlier stuff works for me musically. And I know that a lot of Melbourne people are very passionate about his early years, and that's fine. I respect that. And he had to go through that to get to where he got to. But he became very musical. And some of the arrangements in the later albums are so intricate. And the mood shifts and the interludes, just really beautiful stuff. So, yeah, I went to see Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds when they were out here in May. And Nick and I, you know, exchange emails occasionally.
We got there in the end. Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds and the track Nobody's Baby Now, terrific track, taken from the double CD Songwriters Speak, songs by great Australian and New Zealand songwriters, and it's the companion to the book written by Debbie Kruger, who we were talking to prior to that track. The book's entitled Songwriters Speak, Conversations About Creating Music, and it's out through Limelight Press as we speak in the stores.